In our introductory message in our studies here in the book of Revelation, we argued that this book is developed in a cyclical fashion, that there are seven cycles that John goes through, seven perspectives that John gives in order that we might understand the ultimate message of this book. And we are coming now tonight's class to the third major transition in the book of Revelation. In the first section, we saw the Lord address seven churches, and then we were taken to a scene in heaven where there was a scroll sealed with seven seals, and we are about to come to the place where those seals are ended, and there will now be seven trumpets, and then eventually there will be seven bowls. And rather than trying to understand these things sequentially, most often when you read a book, you have a tendency to read it sequentially or to read it historically and to think that there's the seven seals, and then there's the seven trumpets, and then there's the seven bowls, and to think of it in that category. And what we're arguing again is that we ought to see that the same events are being described, the history of the world from the dawning of the church until the second coming of Christ and the judgment upon unbelievers, as being told seven times from seven different perspectives. We saw that the opening of the seven seals brought us through the church age up until the end of the world. We noted the gospel going forth and persecution following in its wake. We saw then how God deals in judgment with those who persecuted the people of God, bringing such things as war and famine and pestilence upon the world in preview of the judgment to come. And then John did give to us a vivid portrait of that judgment. The opening of the sixth seal revealed the fate of the damned as well as the fate ultimately of the saints. We saw the present order of things coming to an end and the wicked seeking a place of escape from the wrath of God and from the face of the Lamb. And while they are judged, however, we saw that the saints of God, the church militant under the imagery of a large and perfect number of Israelites, are sealed and secured from the outpouring of the wrath of God. We saw then the picture of the church triumphant, having been brought out of this present age in heaven, rejoicing before the throne, being with the Lamb who they loved and served and for whom many of them died. There they are comforted forever. The language of Revelation 7, very similar to the language we're going to find at the end of the book, of the end of the curse, of that place where there is no more sorrow and no more death, and all tears are wiped away out of our eyes. Now, as I mentioned, these cycles, one of which really came to an end in our last studies, go from the time of Christ's first advent to his second. And I think we need to keep that in mind, or as we've said repeatedly, I think the book can become very confusing. The section we have just covered deals with the end, right? The rocks call upon the rocks and hills to fall on us. The church is in heaven with Christ forever. It's a picture of the end. But then we are brought back again. And so what appeared to be the end now starts over again. I think if we don't understand that that's the pattern of the book, it's going to be confusing to try to say, well, that sure sounded like the end. That sure sounded like Christ coming in judgment. That sure sounded like the end of all things, but we must have been wrong because we viewed the book sequentially rather than cyclically. But now we come to the time when the seventh seal is to be opened. And as that seal is open, what we have at first, as we come now to look in chapter 8, in the first couple of verses, we want to consider what John heard and saw. The seventh seal was open, and get somebody to read verses 1 and 2. Go ahead, brother. Yeah, sorry.
I thought you were pulling a dinner.
I was, yeah.
And when he
was silence in heaven about the space of a half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets.
All right, so he's when he opened the seventh seal, now instead of all the other things that we have seen and heard about this great phenomena, there is silence in heaven. This is, I would think, this is one of the more perplexing little passages in the book of Revelation, particularly with this particular timestamp, about half an hour. That's the only time that this particular timestamp is given, at least that I was able to find in a quick survey of the Bible. You have hours, days, 3 hours, you know, 6 hours, the seventh hour. But this particular brief period of time, silence there in heaven, but it's silence that lasts half an hour. So what comes to your mind if you think about this? What might that induce? What might that bring to your heart or your mind, or what effect might that have upon you as this seal is broken open and there is this, now you think about it, would start from now, my watch, till 7:41. If I stood here and you all sat there in silence, and as 30 seconds, see, 30 seconds seems long, doesn't it? An awkward minute. What's stirred up? What is it?
Anxiety.
Maybe a sense of anxiety. What else that comes to mind? Yeah, anticipation, is that what, okay, is that what you're going to say, Sharon? And Sabrina, were you just pointing out your sister there to give her? Yeah, so maybe this sense of anticipation, what else? Yeah, awe. I mean, there are places that if you go to where there's not a lot of talk, I mean, and it's not just sometimes, because, you know, I'm thinking about a place like a museum, where you stand in front of people don't look in front of the Mona Lisa and go, "Holy cow, look at that!" You know, you go something you've seen all your life. You go to the Grand Canyon, and again, there's not this yee-haw. It's often, there can be thousands of people, and there is a reverent silence. Right, so sometimes awe. That might be there. There's some passages in Scripture that you might think of, may not know exactly where they are. You get at least a general idea of the text that talks about the silence before God.
Could it also be preparing our hearts, like before worship, preparing our hearts?
Yeah, that could be possibly this preparation of heart. So Zechariah 2:13 is a text that at least comes to mind if you're we talked about that the subsoil of the book of Revelation is the Old Testament. And John is steeped in that revelation of God, and he draws from a lot of pictures and a lot of allusions from the Old Testament revelation. Zechariah 2:13 says, "Be silent, all flesh, before the Lord, for he is aroused from his holy habitation." God's about to work. God just, as it were, got up from the throne, and there is this hushed silence. Habakkuk 2:20 says, "But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him." So we're not told exactly, but I think those are some things, that sense of anticipation, perhaps anxiety, what's going to happen, awe, reverence, all of those things come in. So that's what John, so what did John hear? Well, the answer is he heard nothing. And he hears nothing for half an hour. And then what does John see?
Seven angels.
I see seven angels. All right, this is really going to be bonus points. Can any of you name them? That's one. Yeah. At least according to tradition. Now, according to Jewish tradition, this goes back to the, if anybody's ever read First Enoch, In 1 Enoch chapter 20, there is a mention of seven angels in the presence of God. And just for your interest, you can deal. So Uriel, Raphael, Michael, Raguel, Sarael, Gabriel, and Remiel are named as the seven angels, according to the Apocrypha, that stand in the presence of God. And again, now this is a vision, right? John's having a vision. So does that mean that the book of Revelation teaches that there are literally seven angels that stand? Well, according to Jewish tradition, there was. But again, John is using apocalyptic language, a particular genre of literature, popular at that particular time. And he uses that would have been very known among the Jewish population. Jewish Christians would have known that. So what's particularly striking about these angels, or what are the angels going to do, or what purpose are they going to serve? What's in their hands, or what are they given? All right, trumpets. And I want you to note again this word given. So they were given. So it's one of those words that's just over and over and over again there, highlighting for us the sovereignty of God. All right, now, what is the purpose of a trumpet? What's that?
To blow.
Yes, right, you blow it. But,
to play it.
So announcements? What was that? A warning. Right, to announce or to warn. So if you're in the city at that time and a trumpet sounds, you think either to yourself, we better look out because something's coming. You know, there may be an army's on its way and the sentry is blowing the trumpet to warn us, or they're getting our attention. Right? Pay attention. So in some places, a little air horn or a whistle or something like that in a very small sense. It grabs your attention. You hear that and you think, all right, stop what I'm doing and pay attention. All right, so this is, again, this little interlude now before the blowing of the trumpets here. So the seventh seal is open. There's this silence in heaven. There are these angels now. So you talk about anticipation that they have these trumpets. And if somebody's holding a trumpet, you're going to expect they're going to probably use it, right? But before that, now we have another angel. And he's mentioned here in verses 3, let's have somebody read 3 through 6. Go ahead, Heather.
Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound.
Okay. All right, so we're going to have to try to get along here with what I always take too much time. You have here a picture of the prayers of God's people. Okay? Now, mixed with their prayer is incense. So there's this golden censer, came and stood before the altar, and he was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of the saints. Now, there's a lot of background temple information here that we could go into. There were bloody sacrifices were offered outside. The incense was offered inside here. And let me just say a few things about this, and then we'll try to get on to more of the trumpets. But let me ask you, what might you think the incense is? So that what is it that's mingled with the prayers of God's people? There's a picture here of prayers being offered before God, and there's also this incense. Now, again, it may not mean anything. One of the things we're going to argue at several times throughout here is that not necessarily every detail has a specific meaning. Just like in some of the parables Jesus tells, you don't have to, like the Good Samaritan, well, what does the inn represent? And well, who's the innkeeper? And what's the oil and what's the wine? And who's the donkey? And all, you know, all of that. When you tell a story, you have these details added to it. But as you think about this, what may be added to the prayers of the saints that make them so effectual? The Holy Spirit, or you guess Travis?
Or like blood, like when the priest would throw blood.
Okay, and what would be the purpose of that? What would that be representative of? Okay. Anybody else? Any other thoughts? Go ahead. Yeah, or even Christ prayer, Christ intercession, the intercessory work there, praying along with us. This is at least some of the commentators bring out. Lenski comments that the incense represents the intercession of Christ for his church, which adds power and efficacy to the prayers of the church. One man named Jeffrey Wilson has a commentary, which is a really nice little commentary to have. Banner of Truth published a whole series of commentaries by Jeffrey Wilson. They're all small, and what he does is just kind of like he's read like 100 commentaries on all these books and then takes the best little quotations or sentence about every verse and occasionally comments himself. But he goes on to note, for it is only as the prayers of the saints are purified by Christ's intercession that they ascend before God as a fragrant offering. Now, we've already seen what prayers are being offered by the saints at this time. You remember, go back to chapter 6 and verse 10, where they cry out with a loud voice, or they're there at the altar, crying out, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" This truth, I think, may help us to understand what's about to happen. Now, what does the angel do with this source of prayer and intercession? He takes the censer. What does he do with it? Verse 5. All right, throws it down on the earth. So this is the answer to the prayer. Takes it, and what's described as this happens, as this censer plummets to earth. What's the phenomena that associates with it? All right, noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. That particular phenomena, what does that sound like? It sounds like judgment. What else? It sounds like Sinai, doesn't it? A bit? Which is interesting. So, the holiness of God, God in action, God speaking, all of that is at least part of what we have there. The prayers of the saints, one has written, return to the earth in wrath. The awesome portents that follow, thunder, voices of storm, lightnings, and earthquake, underline the power of God which is about to be manifested in righteous judgment. And now according to verse 6, the angels set themselves to begin to blow the trumpets, which usher in the judgments of God in answer to the prayers of his saints. So what do we call prayers for judgment? Imprecatory. Is it ever right to pray that God would bring forth and manifest his wrath in answer to the sin of the world? You ever prayed, "Come quickly, Lord Jesus"? You know what you're asking for? You're asking for billions to be judged. If he does that today, right? That's what we're asking for. If we want to see Christ come, then he's going to come in power and glory with his angels, and he's going to bring judgment upon the world. Now, we will note that the first four trumpets have as their focus the sources of life. Okay, so think about that as we turn to these things. Things people take for granted until they are taken away. The land with its vegetation, the sea with its fish, the inland waters, and then the heavenly bodies. And I believe that we shall also now see an Old Testament picture emerging as these judgments are brought forth. All right, so listen out loud. Look at the first trumpet. Verse 7, somebody want to read verse 7? Go ahead, Marie.
The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the trees were burned, and all green grass was burned up.
Okay. So we want to ask the question now, what happens as the first trumpet is blown? What's the major thing? What comes down out of heaven?
Fire.
All right, hail and fire, right? Can you think of a time that God sent hail down upon the earth in judgment? All right, he did that in Egypt. But there are other times when death was hurled from the sky as well. In Ezekiel, there is a picture of the Lord warring against Gog. You read that in Ezekiel 38:22, and I will bring him to judgment. With pestilence and bloodshed, I will rain down on him, on his troops, and on the many peoples who are with him, flooding rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. So what can we derive from this judgment upon the land and vegetation? Right, so again, remember, this is a trumpet blast. This is a portent. This is a warning. What can we derive from judgment upon the land and vegetation? Does this ever happen? Does this ever happen in history that hail and other things have brought about great devastation upon the land in that way? Yeah? He said, well, maybe not exactly like this. There have been times throughout history that great destruction has come in this manner. Right? Vegetation is wiped out. We're going to see this. This is going to happen several times. And certainly, well, in any society, I'm going to say, and certainly in an agricultural society, this really perks you up, and that there would be this kind of devastation. What is it meant to show us? What's that meant to show us? When you have things like, this is more European, Eurocentric, the Great Potato Famine. You heard about that in your history books? Or the Dust Bowl. You ever read about you ever actually read anything in depth about the Dust Bowls? It's incredible what happened. Bangladesh. Yeah. All right. Yeah. When this happens and crops are destroyed, people, it's massive destruction, and particularly in older times when it was harder to get foodstuffs from one place over to another, and it didn't take long, and it doesn't take long if there's that kind of devastation for many people to die. Now, if we are right in thinking through and saying that what we have here are these things not just happening one time, it's not that way in the future there's going to be a time when crops are destroyed, that this has happened repeatedly throughout the history of the world. So there's things like droughts, or there's fires, or there's pestilence of some kind that happens. And what should we do? What should be the effect upon us when we see that?
This place is temporary.
Okay, so among the things, this place is temporary. Anything else? You're cupping your ear, and you're hearing, if you have a mind to see it and hear it, there's a trumpet going off. And you turn on the news, click on something on the internet, and there's this massive devastation. You ought to hear, this is part of, I think, we're learning, you ought to hear something of a sound of a trumpet saying, something's coming, prepare yourselves, take warning, pay attention. Who sends these things? Who's in charge of this? I mean, particularly in this case, I mean, you see, hail's coming down from heaven. Who did that? God did that. Devil didn't do that. God did that. And why were they sent? What's in the context here? Why are they sent? Because people are asking God to judge this world in righteousness. So that's something I think we need to think about when we see this. All right, let's consider the second trumpet, verses 8 and 9. Somebody want to read verses 8 and 9? Go ahead, Joy. All right, now again, this is a vision, right? This is a vision. Even in vision, John speaks of this as being like something. He says, then, and something like a great mountain. Again, so John sees this. What's it look like? What is it? It's like this great mountain. So what might be? I mean, if you try to picture this here, what might seem like a great mountain striking the earth? Well, what would if you saw that, would you think that looks like a, I don't know, an asteroid, something like that? Comet, asteroid, something like that coming down out of, it looked like a mountain on fire. What's that?
Volcano.
Or a volcano. Right. A mountain on fire is a volcano. And if you ever, again, studied what it's like to be in a place, Vesuvius or something like that, where there was this incredible devastation brought about. So he talks about the sea turning to blood. What does that sound like? It sound like something you've read about in the Bible before? What's that?
The Nile.
All right, so again, the Nile. And now in the Nile turning to blood, there were reasons for that. The Egyptians called Nile, the Nile, the like the vein of the veins of Egypt. It was the bloodline of Egypt, and God strikes them there with blood in that. This is, again, a terrible picture that the sea can be used by God to punish and warn mankind. I mean, that's what, again, we're trying to get at here in all of these. There's a sound of a trumpet. And certainly, it would get our attention. I saw there was a headline the other day about one of these people talking about a 6 mile wide asteroid that got in astronomical terms within 300 million miles of Earth or something like that. But enough that you begin to get worried a little bit about it. Of what if that comes and what if that hits here? What's it going to do? And certainly if they said something like that is coming, you all watched all the movies, right? You know what's going to happen is what it would do in obliterating a large part of the earth. Again, God sending judgment down upon the earth, God striking here the waters, death in the waters, waters turning to blood, death in the waters, dead things in the waters as God brings about this judgment. All right, the third trumpet. You have this again, matter of the waters, verses 10 and 11. Anyone want to read that for us? Go ahead.
Then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star was Wormwood. A third of the water became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter.
Okay. Now again, we're remind us, visions, pictures, and if you're trying to say to yourself, well, obviously, quite literally, a star is going to fall upon. So how big are stars? bigger than the earth, right? So something the size of the sun is not going to fall on the earth, right? You have judgment falling from heaven. And now first it looked like a great mountain, and now it looks like a great star falling from heaven, burning like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. So before you had it where the sea is, and the ships were oceans and seas, salt water, And now it's falling where? On fresh water. So inland water. So you have this attack upon the oceans and the as a source of food and a source of commerce there upon the sea with the ships. So the idea of the ships being destroyed is commerce. The death in the sea is economic and also for food. And now we have the fresh waters being taken. God is at work. And a source of life now becomes a source of death. There's death in the water. You read about that at one place in the Old Testament. And that this is, again, a very horrifying picture of judgment. Fourth trumpet, verses 12 and 13. Go ahead.
The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Woe!
All right. So what does this plague remind you of as the sources of light are darkened? Does that remind you of anything?
You can't see anything.
Well, you won't be able to see anything, but is there another judgment? A judgment of darkness? Yeah. So again, I think you have some of this picture of Egypt here. The intensity of the light being reduced, while the second part of the verse indicates a lengthening of the time of darkness on the earth. And again, remember, this is not meant to be a science class. This is not a lesson on astronomy, but rather on theology. And John is using vivid pictures to teach us things. So what does darkness figure in Scripture and in our own lives? When you think about darkness, what do you... Evil, what else?
Sin.
Sin. Anything else?
Danger.
Danger. Yeah, it's scary time, right? You don't tell ghost stories in the daytime, you tell them at night. Kids go take an afternoon nap and they usually aren't, well, they're only crying because they don't want to take a nap, but they're not afraid. During the day, people generally don't get afraid during the day. So darkness is a figure of, you know, gloom, darkness, doom, all of that. And it's often used in association with judgment. You read, for instance, in Isaiah 13:9, "Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellation will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and lay down the haughtiness of the terrible." One has written, "The darkness prefigures the doom of the ungodly and is also a prelude to the new exodus of God's people from under the hand of their oppressors. God can turn even the benign influences of the sun and planets into means for the destruction of man. In the countless evils which have their origin in the excess or defect of the power of the sun, we may see an illustration of the fulfillment of this judgment." So again, this is meant to be scary stuff. Again, you walk out tomorrow and you think about particularly the ancient people, when an eclipse would come, a part of the sun would be covered. They didn't understand what was happening. It was always viewed, this is an omen. This is the gods. This is something happening. And we lose that sense of awe, but there ought to be in that, even in that. That there you are, noonday, and suddenly it's dark. And remember, the eclipse came pretty close here, or we had a pretty good view of it a couple of summers ago, whenever it was, and you remember what it was like, how gloomy it all of a sudden became? What if that happened? And it wasn't just a passing thing, but a moment. You begin to be terrified. What's happening? Where's the light? The light of the stars. A clear night, and yet the stars and the moon aren't giving their light. All right, well, now you have, and depending on what translation you have either a flying eagle, which is obviously a representation of the United States of America here in the Book of Revelation. Y'all were waiting for that, right? Or angel. And so there is, the New King James says, angel, a lot of translations, which would, some would say better manuscripts declares, uses the imagery of an eagle. And again, you have to, this is one of the texts among many that underscores something is being conveyed to us in symbols. There, so that you can't say, well, to take the Bible seriously, we have to believe that there's going to be a gigantic preaching eagle flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, that's not to say what's being conveyed. Well, what's being conveyed is that God is through these means, and again, whether you say it's an angel, or you argue that it should be an eagle, what's important here is the message that's being given. Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. Which is to say, listen, you thought it was bad? This all sound bad? God in judgment, God judging the earth, God acting on the earth, God through natural phenomenon and natural disasters and droughts and pestilence and famine, economic woes and blights, land being destroyed, waters turning foul, the things you look at for life, and then this picture of the constellations and the sun and the moon being darkened. All of this is terrible. And again, the idea is, pay attention. Listen, listen. God is at work and God is doing something. Well, let's see if we can get to the fifth trumpet. And let me go ahead. I'm just going to read that myself, and then we're going to make a few comments in light of the time. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. To him. All right, now the star now is a hymn. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit or the abyss. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as scorpions of the earth have power. And they were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and they will not find it. They will desire to die and death will flee from them. The shape of the locust was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lions' teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek has the name Apollyon. One woe is past. Remember, woe, woe, woe. Woe, one woe is past. Behold, still two more woes are coming after these things. With these words of impending woe and doom, what's the first thing that John sees? The star, right? And who is the star? Who is he? Well, we're told right there in verse 10. Who is it? Who's Apollyon? What name do we usually use for Apollyon? If John Bunyan were here, he'd have his hand up in the air. Right? Who did Bunyan fight? Satan. Right? All right, this is the angel falling from heaven. It's the angel of the bottomless pit. Jesus said in Luke 10, 18, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Satan had at one time been a beautiful heavenly being, but having rebelled against God, he and other angels were cast out of the immediate presence of God. Jude refers to them as angels who did not keep their proper domain, but who have left their own abode, living in darkness. So what does this angel have? Well, he has a key to the bottomless pit. And again, you ask the question, all right, it was given to him. So who gave it to him? Who gave the key to him? Yeah, all right, well, the living God gave it to him, right? Therefore, under whose control is Apollyon? All right, so again, there is, you know, this idea that there are these equal eternal forces of good and evil, darkness and light, fighting together, and both of them, sometimes one wins and some the other does. You know, all things are working out for the good of God's people and for His glory. So what is this bottomless pit? Where do we have, or what picture is given here of this bottomless pit? What's that? Well, technically, I'm going to say Hades and Sheol, the grave, there's something more here. I don't need to look at it just in light of the time, but in Luke 8:31, where you have the demon-possessed man, Legion, Jesus asked him, verse 30, what is your name? He said, Legion, because many demons had entered him, and they begged him that he would not command them to go out into the abyss, the bottomless pit. So whatever this is here, it is associated with the devil and with his angels. Remember, Jesus talks about that hell is a place created for the devil and his angels. So likely a reference to hell before the final judgment, that he has this power. The big question here, though, is, what does it mean that Satan opens the pit? When he opens this pit, what is he doing? Or what's happening as the pit is opened?
Fire's coming in.
What's that?
Fire.
Okay. So, all right, so you have these. Go ahead, Wanda.
Has to do with soul, right? I don't know how to say it.
Well, if the bottomless pit is the abode of the damned and it's the place of the demons and Satan, as it were, opens it up. Now, is something going to go into it? I don't even think about things going into hell, but what's happening here? What's the picture? Something comes out of hell. Right? These really bizarre, it's the picture of these incredible locusts. Now, if you ever want to have, you know, there's all kinds of speculation about trying to figure out, you know, why these locusts look the way that they do. If I were to draw this for you, and I think probably 20 years ago I actually tried to draw this a little bit. If you were to see that in a movie, all right, trying to picture what it looks like, these large locusts with breastplates, the face of men, the hair of women, teeth like a lion. Your wings make this incredible sound. And they come swarming out of hell. What's that? What would that do? If you had a little kid with you, what would you do? You'd cover their eyes, right? You think you're going to be scarred by this. The kind of thing you look back on. It's terrifying. Something's coming up out of hell. And so what you have here is, just as God is using the created world to bring judgment upon the earth, I think that's really what you're looking at overall here, that God gives these warnings, that God's taking sin seriously. This world's coming to an end. It's temporary. It's temporal. You're going to try to find all your security here. Well, all of this can turn against you. And now the reality that God not only allows the world to be judged and warned through natural phenomenon, but also now through satanic activity as well. It's the forces of hell being stirred up against mankind. And I think, again, if we try to say, well, I want to know what that breastplate is, and why do they have hair like women? I think we're missing what's being said here. Satan opens the pit. In a sense, but you want to say, which is worse? The forces of flood or a tornado which lasts for a few moments and destroys property and breaks bones? Or the forces of hell being unleashed which torment men? Well, what's the first thing that comes out of the pit? And again, what does it do? We've already mentioned this. All right, so then out of the smoke, locusts came. All right, so the first thing is, opens a bottomless pit. Smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. So the smoke comes out. It's the first thing. The smoke comes out. What does the smoke do? It darkens. What does Satan do? What does Satan want to do to the minds of men? All right, he wants to darken. He's a deceiver, blinder. Blinded eyes, deceiving. He labors to block out the light of God's glory and the truth of his revelation. One commentator says, it is the smoke of deception and delusion, of pain and sorrow, of moral darkness and degradation that is constantly pouring out of hell. And there's so much we could say about that. Next, he sees this picture of locusts. Now, locusts for people in that part of the world and for farmers in certain parts of our country, you want to get them queasy. Just talk about locusts. You read about locusts in Exodus 10, one of the judgments. In Joel 1, you see something of the power of locusts. They're destroyers. They strip away life. But these are not real locusts being spoken of here. Okay, they come out of hell. But just as locusts are agents of destruction, so whatever this is, and I think you have the idea here, it's something grisly and demonic that has this horrifying effect. So again, not real locusts. You read, look at that description again in 7 through 11. You take all of this together, and what do you have? Again, well, it's meant to be terrifying. They're ruled over by the destroyer. Jesus teaches that Satan is a liar and a murderer from the beginning. He's often portrayed in today's entertainment as sleek and smooth, but that he's the source of joy and power and seduction. But that's far from the case. So what do we make here? It talks about that they have this scorpion-like power that brings great pain and burning for a period of 5 months. Well, let me just say this about that quickly again, because we're really out of time. Locusts are generally born in their swarms in the spring and die in the summer, a period of about 5 months. He's using some of that imagery to carry on the picture there. But they have here this power, these demonic beings, or this demonic activity. Powerful, painful, but in this sense, not fatal. What does this torment cause men to do? Well, they long for death, but there is no death. It's a picture of hopelessness and gloom and despair. Here's a picture again of hell blinding men, robbing them of the light of God's goodness and presence and revelation. It's a picture of hell filling the hearts of people with dread and horror, causing them to despair of life even as they continue to go on day by day. In Job 3:20, we read, why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter of soul who long for death and it does not come and search for it more than hidden treasures who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. That's a pretty miserable picture, isn't it? Of despair. People longing for the grave, and yet they don't want to take their life. Or in some cases, you know, people, I know people that have tried and failed. And so let me just say here that we need to be aware that we view our world correctly. We need to see in the world, in the activities of the world, and the squalor of the world, and the painful things that we see around us, that this is not just random happenstance, that it's not just tragedy out there, one upon another, but there's something more going on there. And if we don't understand, I mean, it seems clear to us, I think, as believers right now, maybe as rarely than we've ever seen, and at least in our generation, that there is a deception going on around us among our fellow citizens. And you cannot understand despair and spiritual blindness apart from that star which has fallen from heaven. We must not live in or interact in this world as though there were no devil. We can begin to doubt the reality of these things at times, because it seems medieval, or it's, you know, Satan's just a metaphor or whatever else. And we're trying to tell people, you know, who live in darkness. I mean, there are people who have the smoke from the abyss has gone out and it's darkened, and we see things and they don't see them. We need to understand not just the blast of the trumpet, but we need to understand the activity of the serpent. The Bible says that if you are not sealed by God, that is to say, if you are not saved by grace, then you have a relationship with the enemy of your soul. We read about that in Ephesians 2:2, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. That's the reality of it. The God of this age, we read in 2 Corinthians 4:4, has blinded the eyes of those who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. So we need to understand these things. If we're going to understand, sometimes you grieve for certain people and you think to yourself, well, what's going on? Well, sometimes it's not just that you can explain all of this stuff circumstantially, that there's demonic activity that really does go on and really does bring about this kind of horror in the lives of real people. And there are real reminders in this world, day by day, week by week, month by month, that the end is coming, that this world cannot forever go on like this, and that these things that happen, that affect the world in the way that they do, are reminders to us of the judgment to come. Well, that took longer than I had hoped. You'll pick up next week at verse 13. Hans is going to teach next week, and then Pastor John's going to take a couple of cracks after that. I'm going to be flying somewhere over the Pacific next time you meet, on my way to Australia. Leave on Tuesday and arrive in Australia on Thursday, their Thursday. So I'd appreciate your prayers for that. I'll be ministering 8 times to the saints there in Australia.